this is Monocle Reads. I'm Georgina Godwin, and today I'm speaking to Clement Knox, who's author of the brand new Strange Antics, A History of Seduction. Clement was born in Hong Kong and studied modern history at Oxford before going on to study international relations and economics at Johns Hopkins. Now, he currently lives in London. He works for Waterstones as a non-fiction buyer. And this book, his first, traces the history of seduction in its various incarnations, from the Garden of Eden right up to the modern Me Too court of public opinion. Clement, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I am fascinated by your job as a non-fiction buyer for Waterstones, and presumably that's one of the reasons this book came about. You spotted a gap in the market.
Yeah. Also, I mean, working in a bookshop all day long, naturally, you're interested in books. You're always drawn to writing. And this was a subject which kind of presented itself to me because the history of seduction and the history of bookselling and literature are very closely intertwined, as I hope I make clear in the book. And so it seemed like an obvious candidate for a subject which has often been at the heart of our cultural concerns, but has never really been fully addressed by historians.
Exactly. As you say, this is the first history of its kind.
Yeah, I did look for others and I couldn't find any.
Yeah. One thing that absolutely fascinates me about this book, and it's on the blurb in the front and it's all the way through, is that you keep talking about the problem of seduction. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't find being seduced or indeed seducing a problem. It's pleasurable.
Yeah, and that is one half of the history. The book really begins in the 1700s with the Enlightenment, when it began to be widely accepted that sexual freedom was the norm. Now, they defined sexual freedom really as being able to choose who you married, which might to us seem quite limited, but was a big improvement on, say, what came before, where marriages were often organised by families and women were really treated like chattel throughout their lives. And then obviously by the end of the 18th century, you have Jane Austen, and the idea that women would be forced into marriage was seen as totally unacceptable. But as soon as you have that question of sexual freedom being the norm, you have the other aspect of what if things go wrong? What if people who are immature or vulnerable or otherwise liable to making mistakes in what was considered the most, dangerous field for women, what if things go wrong? And that is one half of the history of seduction. And the other half is a story about freedom and enjoyment and leisure. And I think that is a dualism you can trace from the 1700s all the way to today.
Mm. I mean, I suppose it is what you mean by seduction, because if you then bring in things like, I don't know, Me Too, that's not seduction, it's rape.
Indeed.
And there is a very definite distinction between something that has often been seen as a gentle art and something that is just brutal force.
And that is actually a criticism which goes back to Ovid. I mean, Ovid obviously wrote the Ars Amatoria, and that was criticised as early as the 14th century by proto-feminists like Christine de Pizan, who observed that what he considered seduction, she considered sexual assault. If you look at 18th century novelists like Samuel Richardson, what they defined as seduction under in books like Pamela or Clarissa would be illegal today.
Mm.
But if you then look at in other periods like the 1890s, when there was this vast attempt to create a body of seduction law, a lot of the what was criminalised then would be considered, only 30 years later in the 60s, in some cases, because those laws lasted for a long time, to be perfectly acceptable forms of courtship. So it's an interesting word because it means different things in different times and is mobilised in different ways.
Yeah. I mean, could one say that all forms of art or persuasion or diplomacy, anything where one party achieves a willed outcome through the use of soft power, if you like, could that count as seduction? Is sexual seduction simply the most primal or animal form of this capacity to persuade?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's totally true. And if you take sex out of it and think of other domains where people use persuasion, where they kind of talk up one aspect and maybe ignore other parts, you look at marketing or sales or diplomacy, as you mentioned, yeah, this is par for the course. But clearly, sexuality is very close to us. It's the most intimate of matters. And when things go wrong there, the stakes are very different.
Mm. Give us some idea of the arc of this book, because it's absolutely huge. It's nearly 500 pages. And you really do start from the Garden of Eden and go onwards. Although, actually, you start with a case that happened in America, which in a way sums up everything that you're talking about. This is Wood versus Chivers.
Yeah. So that was a seduction case in Georgia in the 1870s, I believe, which was a very typical example of how seduction law worked in the US, which was that you had these laws designed to protect vulnerable women up to the age of 25 normally, but sometimes the plaintiffs could be even older, who had been mistreated by men. Typically, seduction was defined as someone who had sex under the promise of marriage. So they believed that the man was going to marry them later, and so they had sex. And then when the man went back on that or ran away or whatever, they had a case in before a jury to sue for damages. And this case is interesting because Chivers won the first case because she had been exploited by this man who was her guardian and was also a local priest, and then lost on appeal. And the reason she lost on appeal was because that most of these laws stipulated that women had to reach certain moral standards in order to get protection under the law. So, and the language of the law was very broad. Basically, they had to demonstrate they had a previously moral character or had been chaste. And this was left in the hands of the jury to decide how that was defined. And normally they defined it by reference to class, by reference to race, and by reference to, you know, rumour and hearsay about those that person's goings-on. And in this case, all of those three factors were mobilised against Chivers. She was accused of being basically white trash. She was accused of having people in her family who consorted with black Americans. And she was accused of being promiscuous. And that was used to overturn the conviction and let off her abuser. So that is kind of the, as you say, that's kind of the history of the entire debate, is who gets protection and who doesn't, who is justified in having our concern and who doesn't. And that is a very knotty issue.
And that women are always often blamed then for just being immoral. It turns out just to be because she allowed it, therefore she must be a tart or
exactly
whatever
the
vernacular of the day says. So this, as we say, moves through various, you get very classical with us, you tell us many things. One thing that I wonder about is that it's not always, of course, that men seduce women. Quite often women seduce men.
Right. It's an interesting aspect of the book that in terms of the courts, we don't really have a legal language to express that side of it. In fact, is largely ignored. We do have a literary language to express it, and that, again, has this dichotomy. One half of it is very free-thinking and positive. You know, if you think about the 1960s and 70s, books like Erica Jong's Fear of Flying or The Graduate, where you have these kind of female protagonists who are totally in control of their sexuality, and that's kind of celebrated. And then you have the other half of it where it's seen as this kind of total inversion of the norm. Mm. And one interesting example of this is vampire literature, where often female vampires who prey on men are seen as the embodiments of everything which is terrifying about sexual freedom in women, and is often married to a kind of political subversion. And that is true in Dracula. It's also true if you go back to someone like Mary Wollstonecraft and the women of the French Revolution, their kind of political subversion was often linked with a kind of what was deemed a moral failure in their insistence on living outside of marriage and pursuing independent sexual lives.
Mm. And even if you go back to witchcraft in the Middle Ages.
Indeed. Yeah. Which is something I don't go into much in the book, but is a fascinating example of how sexually independent women, or even women who just don't choose to marry and live outside of that norm, are often kind of imagined as monsters to justify their destruction.
Mm. To sort of bring it forward, one of the phenomena that we've seen quite recently is pickup artists. Mm. Neil Strauss, I think, was the most famous. And he wrote a book about how to do it and inspired many men to do this. Just tell us a little about that.
Yeah, I mean, Neil Strauss was a New York Times journalist. He was ghostwritten a few books for musicians like Motley Crue, I think, and a few others. So he was a respectable guy in American literary circles. He wrote this book, which was kind of a memoir come how-to guide about his experience of this world of the pickup artist, and it sold millions of copies. If you talked to publishers in New York and London 5 years ago and asked them about that book, they would say that at one time that was what everyone was talking about. And there was a female equivalent called The Rules, which came out a generation before, which had been caused a similar stir. And Strauss became a celebrity. He was on national TV. He was invited to the Oxford Union. His mentor, this very strange man called Mystery, got a TV show, where he did a reality TV show where this was kind of like taught on VH1. And then it all kind of came unstuck quite spectacularly, because basically the zeitgeist changed. People went from thinking this being maybe distasteful but harmless for it now being seen as almost totally outside the realms of polite society.
And of course that brings us to Me Too.
Indeed.
Me Too plus pickup artists equals Love Island? In terms of equations. Tell me about Love Island and where things like that fit in. I'm quite sure you don't watch it, nor do I, but we both know the premise that it's a reality television show. You put these young, very attractive people on an island, you film them 24 hours a day, and you instruct them basically to have sex with each other.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't watched it. I do know enough to maybe make some cautious comments. I think the fact that that kind of program can coexist with the kind of outrage surrounding Me Too is a sign that this kind of dichotomy exists at all times in our society. And so moral outrage lives alongside prurience, and it is very weird to live through if you're not fully committed to one side or the other, because it is odd that we would have that on ITV and being a kind of global international hit, which everyone talks about, while at the same time, you know, our media and literary and publishing classes are kind of fixated on the very opposite. And yeah, it is weird.
Now, there were a number of women, particularly high-profile French women, who wrote to a newspaper saying that basically Me Too was killing the art of seduction and flirting. Mm. Where would you stand on that?
I think as English men and women, we should be very careful about judging the French.
We've always judged the French.
No, I mean, in terms of that, they are masters of the subject and we are very much dilettantes. But yeah, I think that was interesting because it was portrayed as a generational thing. It was kind of these kind of veterans of the 70s who didn't really understand the kids of today. And that was very much how it was framed. I believe one or two of those women later sort of came to the light and recanted, or at least modulated what they said. My preference, just from looking at the history of how we've talked about these things, is to think about it more in terms of different views of agency. I think people like Brigitte Bardot, if you read what she was saying in the late 60s, she was basically trying to become a male Don Juan. And she was cast in a film as the female Don Juan. And she said things which were basically totally explicit about wanting to reclaim female sexuality and be an agent rather than a victim. And it's unsurprising that someone like that would then find it very hard to understand maybe another generation whose view was much more grounded in problems of vulnerability and exploitation and grooming. And that is just a conflict where neither side is necessarily right or wrong, but it is a fundamental opposition in views.
Mm. So, I mean, this book really sheds light on how desire, courtship and power, very importantly power, evolve with our changing world. Where are we now?
Sadly, reading about the past doesn't make you much better at predicting the future. But my real observation, which is what I refer to in the conclusion, is that sexual culture is not this kind of onward march of progress. People like to think that things get better with time, and they like to create narratives which would support that point of view. But actually, if you look at just the changes that have happened in the last 15 years, it's hard to know whether that is progress or that is just a simply changing of the guard in terms of how we view these things. And if you look back, you know, Georgian London or mid-18th century Venice were totally decadent, debauched places. And then by the 19th century, you had official Victorian morality, and there was a lot less kind of unrestrained promiscuity going on. Likewise, in the 20th century, 1920s were a lot more carefree than the 1940s and 50s. The 1960s and 70s were more unrestrained than, say, the 80s. So sexual culture is protean. It changes. It's not a kind of onward march from the bad to the good. That having been said, there obviously are, you know, other things that come into play. You know, economics, the economic prospects for men and women have changed a lot over the last 300 years. The law has also become more nuanced and better able to adapt to changing mores. But I don't really know how this ends up. I don't know how, if in 10 years you'll say to someone in the street, "Me too," and they'll look at you blankly, or they'll recognise that as being kind of a landmark in how we think about sex.
Clement Knox's book, Strange Antics, A History of Seduction, is published by William Collins. You're listening to Monocle Reads, thanks to the production team of Nora Hall and Giacomo Harper. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.